You could say that we're in the most defining decade of human history, right? There's so much at stake. So what does it mean when the most powerful and resourced and brilliant amongst us turn to the feathered and the finned and the furred for answers on the next big breakthrough? And that's really what I love about biomimicry. It's not what you'd expect. They're turning to the overlooked creatures, the stuff that we don't even take that seriously. They'll turn to termites for answers on self-cooling buildings, slug slime for surgical superglue, NASA's consulting with slime mold, a brainless one-celled organism, for mapping the dark cosmos. It's fascinating. And the true masters of technology and innovation are everywhere. They're humble and they have nature's lab in common.
Hello and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Linda Ulrich. We are interviewing people all over the world who are doing some of the most remarkable work, solving problems large and small, and they are putting a spring in our step. If you get used to joining us once a week, you are going to feel like anything's possible. And we're going to get started on that today with an amazing guest, Katie Losey. Katie is committed to bridging the gap between three important things in our future. Humans, I mean, we're all in this together, nature's genius, and breakthrough innovations. In short, she's all about overlooked wonder, one of my favorite topics. You know, Katie has worked at the intersection of business and conservation for over a decade, and she's gotten herself into some interesting situations which have given her the kind of insights we all need to go forward and learn from nature. She's locked eyes with gorillas in Rwanda. She's dodged rats in New York City and swam alongside orcas in Norway, all in the course of this quest to help us find the possibilities of innovation inspired by nature. There's a whole study and landscape called biomimicry. And in that world, engineering doesn't have to just build on what humans have done. It actually builds insights from 4 billion years of R&D done by Mother Nature herself. We're going to go into a lot more of that, but Katie is going to be a great guide into this world of engineering and innovation that most of us have not heard enough about. Katie's been a member of the Explorers Club since 2015, and she serves on their Public Lecture, Film, and World Oceans Week Committee. She's been guest writing for the Biomimicry Institute since 2019, and her science writing has been featured in courses at the University of Cambridge, Johns Hopkins University, and on the cover story for the University of Richmond magazine, her alma mater. So this is going to be a fabulous conversation about possibility, and you will come away walking with a spring in your step. Welcome, Katie Losey.
Thank you so much. So nice to be here.
Well, I tell you, you and I really stumbled into it when we first had our conversation about biomimicry. I'm not sure I've ever talked about this on the podcast, but I have my second daughter, my middle daughter, has been a biomimicry nut since she was 13. And she won an award, a Global Innovation Award, and traveled to Panama with the Biomimicry Institute. Her love of this thing I mentioned in the opening about Mother Nature having done 4 billion years of research and development, this is something she could see had a pathway forward for the world when she was 13 years old. And the rest of us are largely in the dark about biomimicry. So Katie, you know, I've explained my take on biomimicry and how I got there. Why don't you just take just a minute or two to tell us your take on biomimicry and how you got there?
Yeah, I mean, so many people haven't heard of it. I was oblivious to it until about 6 years ago when I had an interaction with a slug that actually introduced me to biomimicry. But in a nutshell, it's consciously looking at nature's genius for solutions and strategies to solve problems and create solutions.
That's it, right? It's like, Instead of all of us just sweating and trying to come up with something out of the blue to solve human problems or problems in the world, you know, it's likely that Mother Nature already solved that thing a billion years ago.
100%. And it's just this idea that why are we locking ourselves into one species, humans? We have just 200,000 years on this planet. And how will that ever compete with 30 million species across 3.8 billion years of research and development and tinkering with their inherited traits? And they've come up with solutions that we could never come up with ourselves. So let's tap into that.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can shift right into the reality here is that people like NASA, MIT, Bill Gates, they are looking to nature for answers. The people who have the resources and the real access to the best science in the world, even they are turning to biomimicry and folks who are, have expertise in this for answers to the big problems that they really care about. So catch us up on all that interest and why should we care and all that?
Yeah, you could say that we're in the most defining decade of human history, right? There's so much at stake. So what does it mean when the most powerful and resourced and brilliant amongst us turn to the feathered and the finned and the furred for answers on the next big breakthrough? And that's really what I love about biomimicry. It's not what you'd expect. They're not just turning to the obvious legends like the sharks and the elephants and the cheetahs and the whales. They're turning to the overlooked creatures, the stuff that we don't even take that seriously. They'll turn to termites for answers on self-cooling buildings, slug slime for surgical superglue. NASA's consulting with slime mold, a brainless one-celled organism with the amount of neurons as a paper towel for mapping the dark cosmos. It's fascinating. So yeah, there's so much I don't know to be true in the world, but I really believe that right now we need innovations that they upend the status quo. And the true masters of technology and innovation are everywhere. They're humble and they have the nature's lab in common. And that's really what this is all about. So,
is so beautifully said. Thank you for saying it just like that. If you see me going like this, you gave me goosebumps. When you gave those three quick examples, that's what I want people to understand. You know, we can look at slug slime for an answer to, you know, surgically closing wounds without stitches. I mean, there are billions of answers just waiting for us in nature like that.
Yeah. And I think that we've kind of always pedestaled human beings and we've always kind of thought of ourselves, many of us, obviously everyone, but so many of us have kind of pedestaled. We think that we're smarter, more intelligent. We have emotions that other animals and creatures don't have, but that's just not the case. And they also have just a skill set and strategies that we would never, you know, be able to get to without them. So I don't know. It really lights me up just thinking about kind of reframing the world and the wild world in that way. They're allies. Yeah.
I like to give people some examples of what inspired me about biomimicry. And the quick ones I can think of off the top of my head was when I learned that the nose of the bullet train was designed to cut through the air faster and lighten the drag on the train and so forth. Well, they use the beak of a kingfisher. The way the kingfisher dives and enters the water, that has so little drag on it that they actually designed the front of the bullet train from that. Another one that I came across that I like to use as examples of what's possible is the fact that I think I've heard somewhere where we could be making the doorknobs in hospitals where infection control is so important. We could be making that on a nanoparticle level, like the skin of a shark, because shark skin does not hold bacteria very well.
Yes.
I mean, those are my two big examples.
I love those examples.
What about you? What are your two favorite examples?
Yeah, I'm going to riff off of two of your examples.
Okay.
One, the shark skin example is fantastic. And it was so good that you mentioned the spaceship. They actually brought that shark skin inspired adhesive to outer space because it was so good. So that, like, in a place where you're like, you need to be so thoughtful about every little thing that you have in there, they brought this material. So that's a huge endorsement for that shark skin adhesive. And then I just learned this, and I think the bullet train is such a cool example, of course. But it's also modeled after two other birds, one being the owl. That's because they're having sound issues too. And owls are silent flyers. Like, you can hear, there's certain birds like a hawk who actually may make noise to stun its prey. An owl wants to fly completely silently. And so they created these small serrations in the wing and applied that to the sides of the bullet train to make it quieter. And then they shaped the belly to be more like an Adélie penguin to lower wind resistance and make it more efficient. So those are two, I feel like those are two kind of lesser known parts of that example, but it's such a good one.
Okay, so let's give people just who haven't run into this notion. I'm a science nerd, so I have, and I never tire of this analogy. But talk to us about, you know, if the Earth were a clock, talk to us about that analogy, or is it a calendar I think maybe it'd be the calendar.
Yeah, it's the 365 day calendar. Yeah.
Yes, that's the analogy. Tell us about that, because that always puts my perspective where it ought to be.
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating. It's equally empowering and terrifying to consider our power and our impact when we look at this calendar year. It consistently blows my mind too. So in essence, if Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years and we condense that into one calendar year, there are a few, I'll share some milestones just to give you perspective. January 1st, Earth is born. February 25th, the first life appears. Fast forward to March 28th, that's when photosynthesis begins. Fast forward to November, that's when the first insects, fungi, fish, land plants appear. December 26th, an asteroid strikes, and that's when dinosaurs go extinct. Now we're at December 31st, 11:36 p.m., primates appear. And December 31st, 11:59 p.m., 2 seconds before midnight is when the Industrial Revolution started. So that's just, it gives me chills because it's the fact that we've been here for those 200,000 years versus the millions of years of life on the planet who have endured and not only endured, but also thrived on this planet. Consider what we're doing in the state, the news, what's going on in the world right now. So it's just kind of this reframe of like, how can we learn from this web of life and just like kind of reframing things as like this, the natural world isn't a warehouse of goods. There are mentors, there are allies. And I just think that beyond the strategies, of course, like, you know, they've passed these hardcore natural selection tests over millions of years, but it's also they're creating conditions conducive to life for all life for the long haul. And that's true progress. And, yeah, I just think it's really important to, it's a humbling calendar, but it's very sobering. But the good news is that this climate chaos, this situation that we found ourselves in is bringing up, it's kind of rearing new levels of gumption and ingenuity and heart that goes across engineers and artists and politicians and students. So we can innovate ourselves out of this. That's up to us.
Yeah. That's such a lovely way to say it, is that it's all about creating progress for everything, right? Not just humans. Like, that's the way nature worked things out. That's such a great point. How about, you know, this bridging concept? I love that about when I read that in my research about your work. You've got this way of thinking that there can be a bridge between technology and biology, which a lot of people don't think about too much, or design and solutions. Talk to us about this bridging concept.
Yeah. I mean, I always have kind of thought of, since learning about biomimicry, I've thought of it as kind of you're bridging biology and technology, but you're bridging so many other things too, right? You're bridging biology and innovation, conservationists and tech wizards, eons, disciplines, the skinned, the scaled, the finned, you know, you're bringing all these things that kind of, so often we operate in silos, that siloed thinking, working in isolation, quarantining ideas, patenting ideas, and kind of nature's open source, right? So, and if we want true progress, we have to do something that we haven't done before. And I really think that includes the simple kind of idea. It's like the simple radical act of cross-pollination and sharing ideas between species and industries and disciplines, corporates, biologists, indigenous people who have been practicing this way for thousands of years, engineers, governments. So yeah, I think it's that idea that in addition to kind of with biomimicry, you're thinking of like almost talking interspecies talking, but it's almost like you're talking to humans that you've never talked to before too. And that's such a beautiful bridge. And you also said the words like practical solutions and true progress. And I think that's like, I think a huge part of this for me is that biomimicry, these ideas, these strategies, these recipes, these solutions, the origin of them are the voiceless. They're honoring the voiceless. They're protecting the voiceless. There are these practical solutions that are not just human-centric, but they're life-centric. They're not just money-centric. They're life-centric. It's such a cool discipline because, and just this practice, because it doesn't lean on altruism, but it's innovation that's rooted in integrity. So I think that combo leads to true progress for the long haul. And yeah, so it's just, you know, that's...
That's lovely. Yeah, it's very well said. It's very well said. Again, you've obviously got a gift to your wordsmith, you're a writer, and you've just got a gift for boiling this down to some really foundational concepts. One of the things you and I decided on when we were chatting in our pre-call was that biomimicry is one of those topics that speaks to the brain. What gets you involved in it, what got me involved in it, was to see my 13-year-old daughter, who just is a crazy science mind. I'm going to put a bunch of links to her work in the show notes. She had a patent on a new kind of wind turbine by age 21 that was based on the locomotion of a cuttlefish. I mean, to have these kinds of ideas in this brain that naturally goes like that, it is a gift. But I'm sure the world is full of children who think like that and who ideate like that, that maybe somehow our rigid education system is sort of shutting that notion of possibility down too soon. So yeah. I want you to talk about this concept of how biomimicry tends to speak to the brain, but it also embodies our heart for the world in the future.
Yeah, no, I love this question. I love it because so many of us think of ourselves as these incredibly rational beings, and we're taught to live from the neck up, right? We're taught to focus on facts and science and data and proof. And I believe in all those things. Yes, I 100% do. And there's a reason why hardcore industrialists and engineers and academics are so focused on biomimicry, because we have all of that at our back. But we also need to give credit and honor our hearts in this equation too. You can't deny chills or stop your heart from beating and like getting excited about something. You feel that in your bones. And that type of understanding, like that's something that you can go for a walk in the woods. It's like this kind of firsthand learned experience is just as sacred and valuable as anything that a textbook will teach you and that our rational minds can make sense of. So I think that's a really big, I just love this question because there's a huge difference between thinking and really knowing. And that's at the heart of what biomimicry is, right? It's both. It's so highly practical and solution oriented, and it makes you dizzy with wonder and awe and just like, whoa, how is this, you know, it makes you believe in something more. It does for me. So yeah, I think that,
Well, you know, and that's what I noticed my daughter. And that's why I really dove in myself, because, you know, I get on her laptop and, you know, what most 13-year-old girls were looking at was just all about their presence in social media. And this kid had every single biomimicry video there was on the internet teed up so that she could just like endlessly.
How cool. I wish that. Oh my gosh.
Nice. She has her own. Yes. And I think that, did you run across her own little video series she made when she was in college, The Nature Nerd?
Yes. I actually, when you initially reached out to me, I did some digging into your daughter. And I found her site, Nature, I think, it was called like naturenerd.org or something. And it's like kind of what I call myself, the same thing. I felt an instant connection to her, but I also admire so much. Like I found out about this idea of biomimicry like 5-6 years ago. And I just wonder what my life, how things would have shifted. Like I've really loved the course of my life in many, but of course I wonder how things would have been different if I had been exposed to biomimicry as a discipline at, in high school. I'm jealous, and it's so wonderful.
Well, and she did become an engineer, and she is looking and working in the world with that same mindset. Not right where she ought to be yet, but you don't get to start right where you want. She's doing some amazing things, but I bring that up over and over again because one of the things she taught me was the possibilities that open up when we start nurturing, and you just brought it up too, when we start nurturing the little unique alchemy in young people as early as possible on topics like this, gosh knows what's possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you said this beautiful thing when we were talking in the pre-call. You said, there is nothing more elegant and coated with possibility than nature. Mm. And I think that's what young minds are really tuned in to notice, the elegant simplicity of things that are obvious to them and so not obvious to us. Talk about this elegant coated possibility in nature. Mm.
Yeah, I'm going to answer this. I'm going to try to answer this question with a question that helps paint the picture for me. So Linda, what would you say is the strongest biological material on Earth? Stronger than steel, stronger than Kevlar, the stuff that Bulletproof Vests are made from.
Spider webs.
Good answer, but no. It lasted for a long time. They thought it was spider webs.
Okay.
Spider silk, which is 5 times stronger than steel, ounce per ounce. But it's the tooth of a limpet. And if you don't know what a limpet is, it's that it's an ocean creature. They have a shell here.
They sit like a little flat, rounded cap.
It's kind of like a conical shell. This is a limpet shell. So you've probably passed them hundreds of times, never thought twice. But this organism makes the strongest material, biological material on Earth at room temperature without extra heat, without emissions, without destroying its natural habitat. So to the idea that if you think about how we make steel, the amount of heat and pressure and destruction that goes into that, this limpet is making something that surpasses that material and is supporting the life around it. And to me, that's true elegance and just such a beauty. And you mentioned spider silk. Spider silk is 5 times stronger than steel and lighter than a leaf, right? So it's so impressive how, you know, to consider how the spinnerets, the spider spinnerets, are in the bellies of these spiders. They're, again, working at room temperature without chemicals. The only byproduct is water. And it's just like these are beautiful examples because they typify nature working quietly, humbly, hyper efficiently, elegantly, and just like so simple. It's so beautiful.
We just have to ask better questions. I mean, like, we are not asking enough questions. Like, so it's kind of like, I hate to use this analogy, but in another episode, which I'll put in the show notes, I talked to a really important materials scientist, marketing woman named Brandy Parker. Unbelievable conversation. And we couch the whole discussion in this concept of spaceship Earth. Like, we are on a spaceship together. We are on this planet floating through space. We have everything that we have. We're not going to get any more stuff. We've got all that we've got. And what I love about what you're saying and what biomimicry causes us to do is exactly, if we were in trouble on a spaceship, we would start to look around at what we have, right? We have what, as far as we know, all we're going to have. And if we look at those resources as limited, finite, but start rummaging around in what's already here, we could have the answer to almost all our problems.
No.
Right, Lord knows this whole...
100%. To consider the possibilities when we bring the biological kingdom to the design table, we'd be nuts not to access that collective knowledge. I think you mentioned this woman was in fashion, but if you like, the fashion industry uses more energy than the aviation and shipping sectors combined. It's 2 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases per year. So imagine if the fashion industry started taking cues from spiders and limpets for, you know, to create their materials. It's just, it's really quite interesting. Yeah.
Let's go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about all these natural wonders, and hopefully we'll get you inspired to start looking around your world with a new sense of possibility. You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, we're back, and I have to have Katie talk to us about this journey she's been on, because you are a non-scientist. Like, you talk with so much acumen about this topic that it's easy to think that you also had studied the details of biomimicry since you were 13, but you have a great story, and this non-scientist part of the topic, I think, makes you a great translator. Talk to us a little bit about that.
No, I'm jealous of your daughter, but I'm a person curious about scientists, and I have a lifelong reverence for the natural world, but I'm not a biologist or a chemist or an engineer or a physicist. And for a long time, I felt I was on the back foot because of that, and just felt like I didn't kind of deserve to be speaking about biomimicry. But more recently, I've kind of settled into that role of being a bridge that we spoke about earlier, and really connecting, like being a connector of the biology, the technology, the wonder. And I see so quickly how if people talk over people's heads, it's easy to kind of tap out and just feel like, oh, like this isn't for me. And they can check out, understandably. But I hopefully can kind of distill it into kind of more consumable, compelling concepts that help people kind of grasp it and understand it, and then kind of get it more excited about it. So I want to support the scientists like your daughter and the startups, screaming to the rooftops about their innovations and technologies. But just as important, I think that it's like trying to break through to the students that are barely paying attention in class, or the hardcore corporates, the parents, the nature nerds. So yeah, and it's interesting. Like I don't really know where what's going to land, what's going to hit with people when I write about a topic. And we met through one of the articles I wrote called The Bizarre Genius of a Brainless Blob about slime molds. But it's been so wild to think about what the notes and letters that I've received from people that are excited about it, and just like that they're trying to incorporate it into their work. Like, for instance, there's a woman, she's in sustainable development. She's one of Bloomberg's public innovation champions. She's pioneering this, or she's trying to like pioneer the economic development for a city in Brazil, but she's in the government and she shared that article with her colleagues to get inspirations for their next capital infrastructure project. How cool.
Wow.
Yeah. There's like a STEAM educator who sits on the board of the National Science Foundation. She wants to, it inspired her to like, she wants to bring it into the curriculum for her schools. Or there's somebody that he worked at a think tank, and he was like, we need a biomimic on our team. We need people at the design table. And this article made me rethink that. So I was just like, this is really great. And you just don't know, kind of like, I'm not a scientist and I don't claim to be, I'm not a biomimicry expert. You know, I'm really intrigued by it. I admire it. I love it. But I'm so quick to kind of be clear on that, because it's incredible kind of like just trying to put yourself out there and seeing what happens. And that's been a beautiful kind of learning around this as well. In addition to the kind of the wonder and the strategies, it's just like, just try, put yourself out there, see what happens. Yeah.
To that point, I completely forgot how we met, but I read that article and I contacted you.
Yeah.
That's what happened. And
yeah.
Because we have written about slime mold. Okay. So first I need to let people know that if they see me taking notes and waving around a pen, I'm taking really careful notes, because there will be a beautiful article about this, complete, way more complete than you can find on Spotify or Apple Tunes or what have you. But there'll be a complete article about this, and every single thing that Katie and I have referenced will be in that article. So we'll put a link to the article we're talking about in the show notes, and the article at the Goodness Exchange under the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast there. And I'll also put there some links to the articles that we've written on the Goodness Exchange about slime mold, because slime mold is this...
all the rage. It's all the rage.
It's the rage in the world.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, if you could please, it's not the same as, but it talks your story about the slug. It's just a window into the kind of wonder that things like slime mold and spider silk tell us the story about the slug.
Yeah, I mean, this is rewinding decades, but you know, some of the most formative parts of my childhood, really, you know, you think about your parents and your friends and your teachers. But one of the most formative forces was the stream behind my house. I would go down there and I don't know, I knew every rock, all the rocks that wobble to avoid so you don't like twist an ankle. I knew where to find the minnow pockets. I knew where to, like, you know, how to catch a crayfish with my hands. Like, I just loved that place. And about 6 years ago, I brought my niece back down there just to, you know, such a part of my childhood. And we were playing in the stream. We, you know, encountered a slug, as you do. We were playing with it. And, you know, hours later, I was like, after the fifth or sixth time of trying to wash the slug slime off my hands, I said to Atlee, I was like, listen, I promise you this is going to be the invention of something one day. Like, this is such the stubborn slime. We cannot get it off our hands. It has to be behind some invention. And then I kid you not, hours later, we're listening to Guy Raz on NPR. He has this incredible kids program called Wow in the World. And they were talking about how slug slime is informing a new surgical superglue. And it just, like, it was one of those, like, hit you over the head, like, okay, this is, you know, you have an idea of what biomimicry is because you see planes in the air. Obviously, there's like these more obvious examples, but I'd never heard the word used in that way. And it just kind of completely opened me up to a whole new world and of just like wonder, awe, solutions. And just like, again, that idea of just like bridging the conservation and the futuristic technology is just something that really struck a chord with me. So that's the slug story. That's the slug story.
That's how it goes.
Yeah, that's how it happens.
I tell you, once you start kind of keeping your ears open for this whole topic of biomimicry and innovation, you'll start seeing things or coming up with your own, like, oh, I wonder about this or what if that. And it's a lovely place to just be in your mind, a beautiful, elegant place to be in your mind, almost childlike again, with a sense of possibility.
And I love it. I love that example. I love that slug introduced me to biomimicry because it was a perfect example of flipping the status quo on its head, humbling our egos, finding answers where you'd never think you would ever find them, and just revering something that you normally just would completely disregard or overlook. So I love that. I love that one. It's a lifesaver. Like, a slug could save your life.
It's so huge.
Yeah.
Okay. So then there's this topic that people may be hearing a little bit more that's so well connected to biomimicry that I think we can give people another way into the topic. So I interviewed an amazing man named Paul Hawken, who is the creator of I think it's still the world's most comprehensive climate change mitigation program called Project Drawdown.
Yes, the Bible. I love it. Yes.
It's the Bible of climate change mitigation, right? Mm. And I interviewed him quite a long time ago, maybe about a year and a half ago. He's amazing. He's got a new book coming out in May. So I hope to get on his list. He's on my to-do list to contact. I'll put that in the show notes because in that interview, we didn't even mention Project Drawdown once. What he was starting to get very interested in, like all innovators, he's running ahead of us all, was the topic of regeneration. I had not heard that word mentioned, and I keep track of what's going on in the media for obvious reasons because I'm searching for good news all the time. But it was new back then. And so we spent the entire beautiful episode on this concept of regeneration. So I'd like you to speak to that a little bit because regeneration is sort of fundamentally linked to biomimicry for the reasons that you mentioned about half an hour ago, that the way to really live a regenerative lifestyle and create a regenerative world is just look at what nature was doing because that's what it was doing all along.
Mm, yeah.
Talk to us about your thoughts.
First of all, I love Paul Hawken as well. And his book Project Drawdown has really been a Bible for me for the last 6 years. But yeah, the way that I think about it, and I'm not an expert, but the way that I think about it is that sustainability is really just not causing harm, right? So, and I see regenerative as going beyond that, focusing on designs and technology solutions that leave things better So yeah, it's just going from like for, you know, our interactions with planet Earth, it's not degrading. It's really helping the planet heal itself. If we take the built world, for example, there's this a crazy statistic, but our built world, the building stock will double by 2060. So that means the equivalent of a new New York City will be built every month until 2060. And so considering that concrete will be the most consumed stuff on the planet after water, it'll be a beast of carbon dioxide emissions. And concrete's not going anywhere. We need to make it better, right? But there are solutions. And with biomimicry, there's solutions. For example, with coral, it's possible that we can have sidewalks and buildings that actually store carbon dioxide and actively sequester the air pollution that's wreaking havoc on our planet, cleaning up the air we breathe and storing it in these structures. And this is not like a far off crazy concept. It's something that's commercial. It's here today. If you go to San Francisco's Terminal One, their airport, you can see this in real life. It's there. So it's really mimicking spiny coral's carbon mineralization process and using carbon as a building block. So I think that's such a great example of regeneration because it's using the built world. It's actually having it behave and actually help protect us. And I think that's just a kind of a reframe, you think, which was, it was new for me.
It's almost like this topic of we can stop trying to charge forward to get what we want, what we need to have more comfort, all that. And instead, I'm not saying we're, what all my guests that I've ever talked to on this topic tell me that if we get creative, we don't have to give up the comfort part of our lives to mm-hmm. save the planet, but mm-hmm. we've got to get awfully creative. Mm-hmm. And there's this emulating part. Like we can emulate nature and come to new places that we can't possibly imagine. Tell us about this quote you and I landed on from Carl Sagan about stardust.
Carl, I just finished his series Cosmos. I don't, have you seen it?
I saw it the original time when it, you know, think about how long ago that was. Carl died in 1993. So Cosmos was probably in the 80s, I'm sure. mid-80s, something like that.
Yeah, I think it came out 1980, yeah.
Yeah, we never missed an episode. It's something and it easily accessed right now and just as meaningful. So we'll put that in the show notes too.
Yeah, yeah. I was just listening to a talk. I'm going to this conference called Bioneers at the end of March. And I was listening to this talk by this guy from, his name is David McConville from the Buckminster Fuller Institute. And he said, we're part of the universe. We're not the center of the universe. And I thought that that kind of tapped into that idea of like Carl Sagan's, we are stardust. It's such a lovely, again, reframe, because sometimes what we fail to acknowledge is that what science has already confirmed is that we are nature. We're the natural world. We are animals. And that remembering really changes things. There's this intense and uncomfortable and beautiful vulnerability and smack you in the face kind of acknowledgement that of our interdependence and interconnectedness, which is, you know, an incredible thing, but I think that oftentimes we think of ourselves as separate and we're not. So yeah, that bond is just, it's everything. And kind of taking it into a different direction. I was listening to a woman that was in my biomimicry course at the Arizona State University. Her name is Azita Ardakani. She's a philanthropist, entrepreneur, fellow biomimicry, lifelong student. But she mentioned to me, or she mentioned on this podcast, I thought it was so interesting, this idea that species don't try to be something that they're not. Like an organism's brilliance is in the majesty of it being itself. And our collective evolution hinges on them being themselves. And I love this idea and concept. I'm very much into kind of self, you know, evolution and becoming the brightest, best version of yourself. And oftentimes that's removing all the conditioning of trying to be something that you're not to try to please others. You know, a butterfly doesn't try to be a snail. A raven doesn't try to be a shark. And this idea of humans radically being ourselves and just kind of stepping into that is such a, it's like a lifelong work, right, for all of us. And I think that there's something about just remembering that, like, we are part, we have an inherent right to be here, and we are part of this, like, magical, majestic, unbelievable world. It strengthens that bond that Carl was talking about. I'm not going to do any of this justice, but
we will send people in a lot of directions. First and foremost, we will send people to the Biomimicry Institute. Let's make sure we talk a good little bit about that, because that's like almost next step for people in my mind. I get their newsletter. I never miss it. I would never just hit delete on that. I every time I dive into it, I got a spring in my step afterwards. Yeah. And I just feel this overwhelming sense of wonder. And then there's, of course, Janine Benyus's remarkable TED Talk. How long ago did she do that TED Talk?
I think she's done a few now. Decades.
The very first one that probably was the one that Louisa landed on, and I. So we're going to give people the links to that, because if you want to really be drawn in a powerful way and all of a sudden be up to speed, it's Janine who is charting the course forward for this advocacy for biomimicry. Would you agree with that?
100%. I mean, I feel like she's the known as like kind of the godmother of biomimicry. Obviously, biomimicry has been around for thousands of years. Indigenous people have been practicing it for, again, eons, but she's really the person that her book kind of coined the term, and she kind of brought it to life for people that had never heard of this concept before, including Dana Baumeister, who they worked together, Biomimicry Institute, Biomimicry 3.8, and they've kind of been in it together since the earliest of days. So, yeah.
Okay, we'll make sure that there's links there for just people who are just naturally curious like me, people that are in engineering. If you're in engineering and you catch this podcast and you haven't heard of the world of biomimicry and engineering, you got to dive in, because you'll be the person with the ideas in your workplace. But also, if folks have kids, like I said, it changed Louisa's life to be a part of the biomimicry's program and all the support she got and the travel. And there's a lot there.
Was she part of the accelerator program?
Yes. Yeah. She was part of the accelerator program all through college. And she did graduate with a patent on this crazy turbine.
Incredible.
And it's just waiting for someone to pick up this idea and use it in tides to create tidal energy, which could be in rivers off to the side and have no negative effects. It's a great idea. It's just waiting for someone to help her pick it up and run with it. Okay, so one of the things we can't get away without asking is, you know, what do you really wish people knew? Like, there's so much you and I could go on talking for another hour. But, you know, I always like my guests kind of near the end to boil things down. Like, when you look at the news or you see the quandaries that our world is in, if you had only had 3 minutes and that's it, you'd share something. What does this world, this life you've led, taught you? What do you really wish people knew?
Well, one, we kind of just hinted at it, but just remembering that we are nature, we are animals. It's not scenery. It's not a postcard. It's not the weather. I believe that's very empowering and humbling and an essential part of all of this. So that's one. Two, I'm on a little bit of a mission to de-pedestal humans. And I don't mean that as a threat. I think it's quite a tonic and makes the world that much more fascinating and interesting when we recognize that we're not the only species that feel emotions or have a unique intelligence. You know, for example, like, elephants can die of a broken heart. They mourn. They can pick up the bones of their relatives or loved ones who have passed and literally mourn. A Venus fly, I just learned yesterday on a TED talk that a Venus flytrap can count. A plant can count. Just so crazy. But there's so much of this wonder out there. And I just feel like we'd all do better, like, we're all better for it if we kind of tap into that. Like, even monarch butterflies, whose bodies are so delicate, they can literally rub off on a flower petal or your hands. They can navigate all the way from Canada all the way back to Mexico, down to the same tree that their great-grandparents lived on, even though they've never been there before. It's just like these wildly magical, fascinating things that the world is full of, but we're just like, we're completely zoned out or numbed out or not paying attention. And I want people to pay attention to those things and know that they're there for them.
And everyday people, right? Like, the other day, I have a part of our farm that we'd like to take down some trees and put in a pond. And so I had some foresters over, and they're chainsaw guys, and that, you know, that's their world is helping people treat their woods like a garden, sort of. But they were absolutely full of wonder when I brought this subject of trees talking to each other.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, if you don't know that topic, there's some amazing books out there on the fact that we know trees are talking to each other. And we've done some articles on the topic, so I'll be sure and share those in the show notes too. But my point is that these are two everyday people that had stumbled upon this notion on their own. And of course, it's right in line with what they do every day. And they actually threw in some concepts while we were talking about which trees we'd take down and which not that were related to this. And they were really thinking it through. It was biomimicry and the topic of knowing more about nature allows us to be more expansive in our own knowledge base, no matter what we do. I really believe that.
It's so interesting. It makes you more interesting and interested in the world. So it's a huge gift.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what do people have, what should people do next? If this, you know, if this wonderful impact that you and I have just talked about for an hour were to sweep through engineering and sweep through the innovation world, what has happened to make that kind of change? Because there will be a lot of people that catch this episode and they have never heard the words biomimicry. And that's such a shame. What has to happen next?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, we need more nature nerds. We need people to talk about it. We need more tech wizards. We need people to talk about it. I'm on a mission to help make biomimicry a household name. And that could be, you know, like what we're doing right now. Invite people on a podcast, have people over for dinner, talk to people at your book club. You know, it doesn't, you know, have somebody, a speaker at your kid's school. There's just so many, it needs to become something that is more mainstream.
How about books that you recommend? Do you have some books that are like, just to get...
I actually have... My computer sitting on one. Bulletproof feathers. This is one.
Hold it up a little bit more towards your camera so people can get it just to the... Yeah, there you go.
This is an old library copy that I probably is overdue.
Podcasts? Are there any podcasts that are specifically focused on biomimicry?
There's just one with... it's called the regenerative... something regenerative... I can send it to you. But it's with... It's like... Yeah, it's a really good primer. It's with Janine Benyus and Dana Biomaster. And that's a very special one since they're both together. One of my, you know, former classmates, Azita Artakani, she's... If you just plug her name into Spotify, she has a few that are really lovely. Just like such a kind of like, she really tugs at that heart element of biomimicry. Right. Just, it's not just the practical emulation. It's the ethos piece. It's the reconnect piece that are also essential elements to, it's like revering the organisms and just having that important bond with nature are essential elements. Because if you think about it, like they were talking about, you know, if you look at a plane in the sky, like let's say 1913, and they talk about it on this podcast with Janine, but you know, they, you know, you invent the plane, it's emulating a bird, wonderful. But then like a decade later, they're dropping bombs out of the sky with that plane. So is that really biomimicry? If you're, it's like, it's, what's the end goal here? Is it benefiting? Is it creating conditions conducive to life, for all life? And you know, there's that moral piece of it that's really kind of key to the whole comprehensive look at what biomimicry really is. So
reminds me of a conversation I had just yesterday that I recorded with an amazing man, Kyle Dodson. And I'll tell you, he talked about something that you just reminded me of. We have these choices. You know, we have the invention of the airplane based off the way birds flies, and then somehow we wound up using that technology to drop bombs. But Kyle talks about our choices in being a part of virtuous circles or virtuous cycles and vicious cycles. This is, I think, what you're talking about is biomimicry and regenerative lifestyles, and all those conversations are all about being part of virtuous cycles.
Yeah.
And anything else that takes us astray, usually it's anything that's really self-focused on the human existence, takes us into the vicious cycles.
It gets like what we're talking about, like those short-term gains that are not, they're not true progress. Like we use those words, true progress. It's not true progress if it's killing off our planet
Yeah. Well, I tell you, thank you so much for this fabulous interview. You have a way with words that I admire and envy, and I can't thank you enough for all the preparation you did for this interview and just the thoughtfulness that at which you're applying your gifts in this world and helping to elevate the Biomimicry Institute to greater acclaim and usefulness. I think it's just a win-win for the world. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Katie, so much. Losey. I really appreciate it. I know this is a topic so close to both of our hearts, and I hope that I did it justice. And I'm just so grateful that you reached out. It's like just such another great example of this bridge that biomimicry just brings together people, that this is just a wonderful conversation. And I'm grateful that I had the chance to speak to you. So thank you, Linda. And
all right. Lovely. I'll hope to connect with Janine at some point in the future as well. Yes. Mm. Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us for another episode of the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I hope the insights that Katie and I shared with you today put a spring in your step, and you have a week that full of wonder and the kind of observations and questions and sense of joy that we've been talking about for the last hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.